Let's talk about sex. Let's talk about sex. It's time to get into talking about Charlie Parker, ladies and gentlemen. Charlie Parker is the greatest saxophonist that ever lived, in my opinion. We're going to talk about him this whole month because it's his centennial year. He would have been 100 years old this year. Oh, my. Oh, my. And I interviewed a gentleman who wrote a great book on Charlie Parker called The Life and Music of Charlie Parker. Bird. Author's name is Chuck Haddix. He's from Kansas City. Charlie Parker's hometown. It was a fun interview. Like I normally do, I'll cut it up in at least two parts. And let's just segue right into the interview. Please forgive some of the phone quality. It wasn't the best phone quality over the internet and stuff like that. But let's get into it. Let's get into it. Right into this interview with Chuck Haddix, the author of the book, The Life and Music of Charlie Bird Parker. Well, first, thanks for doing this. I really, really, really do appreciate it. You know,
I'm glad to do it.
Your book is I've read many books on Charlie Parker, as well as Bebop and the whole era. And yours is the most informative. It's straightforward. There's no like hyperbole. It's all there. And the things that you seem like you're not sure of, you don't go to, you know. What inspired you to write the book?
Well, you know, I'm being from Kansas City, I knew a lot of people that knew Bird. I used to hang out with Buddy Anderson and Piggy Miner, and Jay McShann was a friend of mine too. And I'd hear all these great stories about Bird. And so when I did my Kansas City book with Frank Driggs, after I finished that book, continued writing, and I wrote two chapters on Bird. And I decided not to include them because after reviewing the literature, I realized that he really merited his own biography because previous biographies had been inaccurate. And also they hadn't really focused on his time in Kansas City. Mm-hmm. Been given short shrift, and that's a major oversight considering that he spent his first 21 years in Kansas City.
Right.
And he only lived to be 34 years old.
Exactly.
You know, because of his lifestyle, you know, authors had a tendency to sensationalize his life, particularly Ross Russell.
Mm-hmm.
And Russell had an agenda. And I felt that his story had not been told, so I took those two chapters and turned them into a book. And I had access to people that had written about Bird had not come to Kansas City to do research. When I did my Kansas City book, I went to the Kansas City Call, Kansas City's African American newspaper, and I made copies of all of the music references. And I kept running across these references to Charlie Parker that no one had seen before, you know, so I was able to tell his story, both professionally and personally, you know, using my research here. And also I had access to individuals that knew him, and one of the things that struck me was that how much myth surrounded Bird. And so what I tried to do is strip away the myth and just tell his story in a very straight ahead manner and not sensationalize it. You don't have to sensationalize Bird's life. He did enough to his own life.
That's very true.
His own life.
That's very true. That's true.
I
mean, when you read upon him, and you're absolutely right, his Kansas City time and his hometown is where Bird was bebop was born. A lot of people say it was born in New York, but I beg to differ. I think his coming of age happened when he with Jay McCann. I mean,
yeah, it's in the record. I have a recording in the Morrisound archive. It's from the John Tumino collection. Of him playing "I'm Getting Sentimental Over You" with the Jerry McCann Band. They were playing the Century Room at the time, which was a white club on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe Coleman does this really straight ahead vocals, you know, like, you know, sings pretty straight ahead. And then Bird just takes a wing and he's playing bebop.
Right.
You know, and you can hear the seeds of that in his Honey Body recording, which was probably from 38.
Hmm.
And so, and Claude Williams told me that Bird was playing bebop in Kansas City. He said they called it crazy music.
Yeah.
So he, you know, and he's the culmination of the Kansas City tradition. You know, of the late night jam sessions where musicians challenge each other and go in by going in and out of key and playing double time. And that's really where Bird learned his craft. And it's an old tradition in Kansas City. Jam sessions were legendary. They went all night long. You know, think about the legendary cutting contest, which occurred December 18th, 1933,
mm-hmm.
when Coleman Hawkins was in town with Fletcher Henderson.
Mm-hmm.
And Basie Band was at the Reno Club. Not the Reno Club, excuse me, the Cherry Blossom. And you know, Coleman Hawkins was engaged in an all-night jam session by Lester Young. And then, you know, Lester ended up besting Coleman Hawkins, the king of the tenor saxophone,
yeah,
in an all-night jam session. And they kept running through pianists, running out of pianists.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, Mary Lou Williams came in because she could interpolate keys.
Right.
And, you know, and Bird, I think, when Bird really came of age musically, it was 1938 when he worked with Buster Smith at Lucille's Paradise on 18th Street. It was an upstairs
mm-hmm.
club,
mm-hmm.
very popular club. And, you know, he learned on the bandstand from Buster Smith, who hasn't really gotten the recognition he should.
I agree.
How to play double time, how to go in and out of key. Jay McCann tells this wonderful story about how he was listening to a broadcast from the Lucille's over KXBY, and he went up to Professor the next day, Buster Smith, and said, "You know, you sounded great last night, Prof." And Prof said, "That wouldn't be that with Charlie Parker."
Yeah, and I read Buster, that in your book. Yeah.
Yeah, and Buster, you know, was a very advanced player. He doesn't get his due because he wasn't as well documented on record. But if you listen to his records he made with Pete Johnson, it sounds just like Bird.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've also read in some other books, there's the book of the diary of Charlie Parker, and there's an interview that he gives to a newspaper at the time, and he said that he wasn't influenced by Lester Young, but there's definitely some Kansas City influence in his playing, and I believe you're right. It's probably Buster that was his biggest musical influence on his horn and his playing. You know, and
Kansas City was a saxophone town.
Mm-hmm.
St. Louis is the city of Gabriels. It's all trumpets.
My hometown.
And he, you know, that's where he learned his craft.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's a number of shall we say, turning points in his career. One of them, of course, is being humiliated at the jam session at the Reno Club by
mm-hmm.
Joe Jones. And
mm-hmm.
Gene Ramey clearly recalls that. Gene Ramey is the reliable narrator in Kansas City jazz history. He and Mary Lou,
mm-hmm.
their accounts have been confirmed by history. And the other is, of course, is Rick when he goes to the Ozarks, to Musser's Ozark Tavern.
Right.
And he, you know, breaks his back and his ribs, and he gets a new saxophone. He'd been experimenting with you know, making his action faster by replacing the springs with rubber bands.
Right.
And sealing the putting plastic wrap on the keys and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And his horn was in terrible shape, and he got a new horn out of it. And according to Gene Ramey, it gave him a lift. And then, of course, the next summer he spends at Musser's with Georgie Lee band, and he really learns his craft there. I mean, he woodsheds because it's a sundown community.
Right.
African Americans would be lynched if they went out after dark in some of these small towns.
Right.
And then he comes back, according to, Gene Ramey, a changed musician. Just transformation was just stunning. When he first started out, he wasn't very accomplished at all. But he became a big star here locally, too. There's a lot of myths surrounding Bird. And one of those is that he wasn't appreciated in Kansas City. He was put down. He wasn't liked. He was a big star with the Harlan Leonard Band and also with the Jay McCann Band.
Yeah, I'm sure.
He was very well known in Kansas City. And when the other watershed incident, of course, is at Wall's Chili Parlor, where he finally plays what he articulates, what he'd been hearing in his head back
mm-hmm.
in Kansas City, and then he comes
mm-hmm.
back to Kansas City. So it's I tried to focus on his life and career and tell it in a very straight ahead manner.
Mm-hmm.
And that had not been done before.
It hadn't. I appreciate it as a person who's spent some time researching Charlie Parker from my play. And, you know, I did all that research before your book came out. And then when your book came out, it was so refreshing. Are there any musicians in Kansas City that have congratulated you? Any family members of, say, Murray Lou or Jay McShann or anyone that nature that really made their name in Kansas City that come up to you and say thank you for writing this book?
Yeah, well, you know, as I'm telling Bird's story in both the Kansas City book and my biography of Bird, I tell Jay McShann's story too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Jay McShann thanked me for that.
Mm-hmm.
I was an honorary pallbearer at his funeral.
And
Jay was a friend of mine, and I know Jay's daughters. We have the Jay McShann collection at the university.
Mm-hmm.
And they are very appreciative of the fact that I gave Jay his flowers and also told Bird's story. I think the highest compliment that I received was from Kim Parker.
Mm.
I didn't contact her when I did the book, and I wish I would have because we became friendly after the book came out. And she felt it was the most accurate portrayal of Bird in his life.
Mm-hmm.
And she really complimented me on it. And that meant a lot because she spent a lot of time with Bird. Hold on.
Okay.
And she, she grew up with Bird. And,
yeah.
And she was his favorite child.
Yeah.
You know, and she had keen insight into his relationship with Chan. And, you know, when Clint Eastwood was well-meaning when he did the movie Bird, but he told it from Chan's perspective.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Chan had an agenda, and it wasn't a fair portrayal of Bird.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're looking at that, you think he sweated all the time and he cried all the time.
Right.
It wasn't like that.
Right.
And they had a very complicated relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
going into that was very, very painful because, you know, when Free dies, things change. And Chan and Bird was somebody that yearned for normalcy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he would like to ride the train into New York City when he was living outside of New York, read a paper and pretended he was a businessman. He was a square.
Right.
And Doris really provided a stable home for him, but she was more his mother than his wife.
Yeah.
Even though she was his wife.
Mm-hmm.
But Chan and his family with Chan gave him an anchor. And when he was cut loose from that, then he just drifted off.
Yeah.
You know, and also, you have to, drug addiction was treated very differently at that time.
Exactly.
There were still people in jail.
Mm-hmm.
But rather than get him treatment, Bird lucked out when he landed in Camarillo because he was rehabilitated there.
Right, right.
But he was always under that shadow of his habit. And also, he struggled with mental illness.
Yeah.
He tried to kill himself at one time, committed himself, on a couple of occasions.
Mm-hmm.
He struggled with that. And you can see it with the pictures, later pictures.
Yes,
And he was, and one of the things I think about his substance abuse and his alcoholism is that he was self-medicating. If he'd gotten treatment, I think it would have been a whole different world for Bird.
I agree. If he'd have slowed down just a bit, I think he'd have just had some bad experiences in those hospitals. And being an African American, in those times, he probably, and a lot of that isn't as documented as your book is because it's in a hospital. But my thinking is that he had enough. And I think maybe he was also just frustrated with some of the choices he'd made near the end of his life. What do you say to that?
I think you're absolutely right. He's talking to, I can't remember the young Muslim's name that took him in, but he talked about how, let's hold hands and jump off the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
He talked about that. And he was unable to get treatment because he was an African American.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time too, mental illness was the crazy uncle in the attic or the crazy aunt in the attic. It was not really something that most people dealt with. And they didn't really have the places to deal with it, too. Look at how African Americans lack access to health care.
Yeah.
And it's evident in the percentage of African Americans that are getting coronavirus.
Yeah, exactly.
Coming up in the 1930s and 1940s is a whole different thing,
It
was even worse,
Yes, considerably, considerably. So, and looking at his whole, from the time when he had the car accident, that got him on heroin and the whole trek from there, cause shortly after that, maybe 3 years after that, 4 years after that, he had this the beginning of the bebop revolution started, and there was never a time where, except Camarillo, where he had a time to really try to tackle this addiction. And then by the time Camarillo happened, he was a star, and there was no time in his life where he could settle and say, okay, I'm going to handle this at all. It seemed from what I read in your book and other books. So, I mean, if he had that time, there's a lot of ifs in everyone's life, but I like to think about that with Charlie Parker a lot. If he did have time to settle, you think about Miles Davis, he had that time to settle. John Coltrane had that time to settle, took that time to settle. He never had those moments in his life to settle down and try to tackle this addiction,
Well, he lived his life and he made his music in the moment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's like he kind of was improvising throughout his whole career and life. And he didn't get that space where, I'm going to take 6 months off and write a symphony.
Right.
And also he had to make a living.
Yeah.
He's a working musician, and he had to play in clubs. And let's face it, club environments at that time, particularly in Kansas City, there's a lot of alcohol, a lot of drugs, a lot
mm-hmm.
of, women, ladies of the night. And, and people that were, you know, criminals.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's kind of funny. I was talking to, some of the people you talk to here, in Kansas City talk about how I interviewed, this guy whose father was a pot dealer here in Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a white guy, and Bird used to go to their house, and he'd go over there with this reverend, I think he called Lavender. And this guy drove a big Cadillac, and he was a reverend. He'd drive Charlie Parker around town. And, you know, and Bud Calvert was his designated driver. He had a cab.
Right.
And Bud Calvert would drive him all over Kansas City. And Bud, I came across his notes on Bird in an article here locally. We're talking about he'd take Bird down to down to Columbus Park or something. That's the north end. That's known as Columbus Park. Mm-hmm. But Bird would score his heroin, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think to understand Bird, you have to understand Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole tradition that really produced Bird. You know, and so you know, that's one advantage I had here living locally, too.
That's true. You can hear the respect for him in your book, if you read the book, anyone that reads the book. And I'll make sure that I'll put a link to your book on the website when I post this podcast. But you can hear that and the respect for the music and the musicians that nurtured him and that whole scene. There was no scene like that in the history of this country when it was happening. And as you say, all the negatives that brought in the musicians from the various territories, as they called it back in those times. Have you ever thought of writing a book about Buster or people like that, like Tommy Douglas and some of the other Kansas City legends or something to that nature?
Well, I've often thought about writing a book on the territorial bands.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Because they have not been well documented.
Mm-hmm.
And they really, it's a really colorful, wonderful story.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I touch on it a little bit
in
my book, and Ross Russell touches on it just a little bit in his book on Kansas City Jazz. But it's really not been fully explored and because most of the musicians we're talking about that came to Kansas City, they came from the territories.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, and also, you know, local 627 had not really been covered, you know, in previous works either. And that's an incredible story of
mm-hmm.
resilience and how it advanced Kansas City jazz.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Charlie Parker was a professional musician by the time he was 15.
I know, in the Union.
You know, in the Union, yeah. And that says something.
It does, about the culture of Kansas City, yeah.
Oh, yeah, it really does. And so, you know, and there's always been snatches of, you know, references to Charlie. Like, for example, Mary Lou Williams remembers he had short pants and he was playing in her band. You know, Ahmed Al-Adin, who is a friend of mine, talks about how he's standing in front of the Boulevard Room, and here comes Charlie Parker, and you know Charlie's standing there talking to him, and he's waiting for Jimmy Beasley to come up, and because Beasley owes him money, this musician mm-hmm. named Beasley,
mm-hmm.
and they had been playing at the at the El Capitan down on 18th Street. And mm-hmm. along comes Bird's aunt, and Bird starts, she says, you know, we play me something. And he goes, well, come on in the bar. She goes, I can't, I'm a church lady. Mm-hmm. I mean, and so he stands there and he plays My Mother's Eyes on the street.
Mm-hmm.
you know, I think you have to capture, if you're doing biography, you have to capture somebody's humanity, and that's what I tried to do with Bird.
Yeah, I believe you did that. Do you play any musical instrument?
No, I used to play the trumpet when I was little.
Hmm.
And I gave it up because I got tired of playing marches.
Right.
That's all we were playing. And I didn't stick with it, and I kind of regret it. I still have my horn. And I don't read music either, but I play by ear, let's put it that way.
That's that's how a lot of great musicians, but Jimi Hendrix was one of those musicians I'd like to, never read music. In reading your book, I found that Chet Baker was one of those musicians who didn't read music. But
he didn't practice either. Jack Sheldon was incredibly jealous because Jack Sheldon had to practice all the time, and Chet Baker never practiced. He just showed up.
Wow. Wow. One of the things when I did my play, I met Doris and Kim through the play. One of the things they both said, and it's in your book, is Charlie Parker practiced like a maniac. He practiced a lot all the time. When the opportunity came, he would, and then a lot of people had, they thought that it was just a natural thing. In that Paul Desmond interview, when he says, you know, he would practice 15 hours a day, and the neighbors were ready to throw his mother out of the place because he was practicing so much. And Paul Desmond admits it, he was startled. He thought that it was just natural. Charlie Parker put in the time on his instrument, though you can tell it was definitely a gifted musician that heard things differently than other musicians, but he did practice. Did anyone else share any experiences with you about how much time he put on his horn, or how he may have done it?
Well, I think that in reaction to, I think he spent a lot of time on his horn because, and when he was humiliated by Joe Jones at the Reno Club, he said, "That will never happen again."
Mm-hmm.
And that's when he began to master his horn.
Mm-hmm.
And also, like any great artist, you want to make your art better. And then, mm-hmm. and he loved to play.
Mm-hmm.
And so he practiced regularly, and mm-hmm. you know, he woodshed, played all summer long, 1936 down in the Ozarks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, throughout his career, he practiced. Yes, he did.
Let's talk about sax. That's the conclusion of the first interview, or the first part of the interview with Chuck Haddix. The second part will come out next week, ladies and gentlemen. It was great talking to him. So informative. I want to thank him for the interview. I also want to thank Reactor Productions for the theme song. I love it. Want to thank Joe Stewart for sound reinforcement. Anchor for podcast distribution. Want to thank my wife, Jane. I want to thank my editor, Rebecca Robinson. One of the inspirations for this podcast, Miles Robinson. I want to thank Levitate Web Solutions for production of the podcast. We have a website, letstalkaboutsax.com. Next week, we're going to conclude this part of our series on Charlie Parker, who's celebrating his 100th birthday in August. August 29th, if I'm correct. Let's talk about sax, ladies and gentlemen. Let's talk about the saxophone.